I was downstairs with the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee, so I wasn't playing hooky. I was in the building with the hall pass.
I have no authority here.
If anybody is here on Senate Bill 700 or House Bill 2535, you missed the train. I left the station yesterday. So although they're on the agenda because of our 36-hour notice requirement, we have to post notice a couple of days ahead of time. We never know when we're finally finished with things. So those bills are not up today. We do have several bills listed for public hearing and possible work session: Senate Bill 443, Senate Bill 506A, Senate Bill 685, Senate Bill 586, excuse me, 686. For those of you here on Senate Bill 686, there will not be a work session for sure on that bill. There will be a hearing, but I will defer a work session. There's a lot of things churning from all that I've heard, and we will not want to rush to judgment on that. Also, we have one gentleman here who needs to leave early, and I'm going to call him up first. Cy, would you please come up? We'll go into public hearing on Senate Bill 686, and I'll let you jump in right away so that you can get out of town before they catch you.
Thank you very much. I understand what Representative Hansen has said, that it's snowing in Central Oregon, so my trip to Pendleton today, he's made my day.
Oh, just here to help.
Yeah, my name is Cy Kornbrod, and I'm a parole and probation officer, and I've been one for 19 years in Oregon, and prior to that, I was a state parole agent in California for 7 years, and I've been in one phase or other for criminal justice system for a long time. I will not read you my testimony. I assume everybody here can read it. I'll highlight it. In the late 80s, when the BPST, when the original certification bill was passed, it only made mandatory certification for employees of the state, then the division of the corrections division, now the Department of Corrections. And in the 80s, I anticipated some real problems in some of the counties. The counties were, most of the large ones were voluntarily sending the people to for certification, but they didn't come under the whole standards of for of who what who constituted a parole and probation officer and what the duties were. So I came down here, and I can't remember whether this is the 87 or the 89 or the 85 session, and at my request, the legislature granted that request and included the counties on these bills. I think that what has happened is there has been a picture painted of the duties of parole and probation officers that isn't really accurate, that implies that certain functions are clerical functions when they are not. Home visits, for example, are not just to knock on the door and see if the person is living where they're living. It's not just to walk in the house and see if there's a violation. People in the higher classifications tend to be in those classifications early on in the process, and it's there where you get a chance to see the person on his own turf, sit there, talk to that person, see the family interaction, and get some feeling for that person's demeanor or his actions. So then later, when they're classified lower and the only place you're seeing them is in the office in general, you can get a better feel for how they're doing and how they're, whether their demeanor has changed, whether their attitude has changed, either for the positive or the negative. And that's important. It's the same thing with office visits. They are not check-ins. They are there to give the PO a chance to talk to that person, find out how they're doing, discuss problems if they're not going to treatment, if they don't have enough money to pay for treatment, how to refer them to agencies that will either upgrade their skills or do job placement. In Columbia County, we have a job club which is run jointly by AFS an organization called MPC Management Training Company, which trains people in electronics and computers and things like that. And those are the things that you find out when you see them either at home or see them in the office. Now, there are functions that can be done by non-certified people. We have a person doing community service work, assigns people to their community service project, and tracks it, but if there's any problems, the PO gets notified and knows how to take the action. The same thing occurs with, she does the tracking on treatment referrals. When we get reports in from treatment, she gets them first. She has a special treatment log, and she enters those results and logs in the report and enters it, and then gives it to the assigned parole and probation officer for whatever action that person has to take. To have somebody do that that's untrained, it takes real judgment. It does not take just the salt of the earth going out there and talking to people and then going back and telling the PO, well, this is what happened. And then the PO, if there's a problem, has to make a decision. For example, the point you have to make a decision, you're going to give an early, you're going to recommend early termination for a person. Are you going to recommend, if the person is in violation, treatment, inpatient treatment, outpatient treatment, are you going to recommend revocation? You know, you have all these things. You can't just get this information secondhand from people who have not been trained and who have not, don't have the educational requirements. And it's sort of akin to saying, okay, we'll replace a lot of state police with cadets without training, and we'll put them out in cars, and they'll make the traffic stops and issue citizen citations to people to appear in court, and then if there's impairment, they'll get on the they'll get on the radio, and they'll get the real state police officer over to handle that. I mean, makes about as much sense as that type of action. I guess you can do anything cheaper. But the problem, and as I put in here, is doing it cheaper. In the long run, are you going to get the same judgments, the same recommendations to courts and boards that you would get if you have a real, live, certified parole and probation officer doing that type of work? I want to touch on one thing I didn't touch
I'm going to interrupt for a moment. Representative Bowman has a question.
Oh, sure.
Before we have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Cy. My question, Cy, is Senate Bill 686 does not say that paraprofessionals will be doing arrests or imposing sanctions or determining treatment plans or anything of that sort. That's, so I'm kind of confused as to why you think that that's the goal of this legislation.
No, that is not the goal, but the effect is this. If I impose a sanction and I do it based on, you know, or request the court to take an action, I do it based on my personal contacts with the offender. In the office when they come in with their monthly report, in the home when I see them. And I don't do it based on information that I get from another party who has not had the training that I have, who has not had the certification that I have, who would be meeting with the people in the office and would be making home visits, would be doing these things, and then tells me, here's what this person did now, and how, and I am then supposed to figure out what is the appropriate sanction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Could I follow up, please?
Sure.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I guess I'm still not getting it. The at least from the way I read this bill, the paraprofessional will not be doing home visits. So they won't be making recommendations back to a parole officer about that.
They will be doing the office check-ins. It with many cases, the lower level especially, say you have driving while suspended, felony. Usually those people have severe substance abuse problems to get to that point. And the reason that they got a felony is because if you revoke for a DUI, it becomes a felony for driving while suspended. But they're generally at a lower level because of their crime, that kind of thing. And they end up, you may at the beginning make some home visits, but after a while, they are in a classification, they've been doing okay in treatment, they're in a classification where they only come into the office.
Mr. Cornbride, I brought you up first in order to give you a chance to get out of town since you had to get to Pendleton. Let me ask you to wrap up your comments because I need to move on to some other things.
Okay. That's what, you know, you're getting stuff fed in through other people, and I don't think that's... The other thing is sex offender notification. One of the problems is that the public view of predatory is usually the guy that grabs kids off the street. That's only about, you know, 1% of the people we deal with. Most of them groom offenders and things like that. One of the objects of notification that you do is to keep the public's fears at a low point, and it's very important to be able to talk to them and explain the dynamics and explain that you're notifying, but that you should, that this person is not the kind that would do that, but you advise them to keep their kids away from them. And so I don't think you want to get fear of them. That's basically what I'm. But I just don't think you can do everything cheaper and get out with the same product.
Thank you, Mr. Cornbrot.
Thank you very much
for coming this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your consideration.
You're welcome. We will recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. What I intend to do is we have a session at 10 o'clock. I have got, besides Mr. Cornbrot, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 persons here to testify on Senate Bill 686. 2, 4, and apparently 7 against. There's obviously a lot of difference of opinion about this bill. The reason I'm mentioning all of this is that I do not anticipate that we would get to that hearing until about 9:25, about 30 minutes from now. In case you have meters to feed or if anybody would like to start having a conversation in the hallway or somewhere else about whether or not there's some resolution possible, and maybe it isn't possible, and then we have to make some decisions, but we'll make decisions anyway. What I would invite folks to think about is the range of duties that parole and probation officers have and some stratification. I think that the Federation of Parole and Probation Officers and some others will be bringing in some very helpful information about their concerns. At the same time, those on the administrative side will have, I'm sure, helpful information about their need for efficiency and cost savings. I throw out the thought that if we invited Judge Thornton in, he'd tell us all about how in his 25-odd visits to Japan, one of the things he found out in Japan was that they have a stratified parole and probation system, and they even use citizen volunteers for low-security parolees. But every parolee, everybody on parole and probation in Japan, has an assigned real person who sees the parolee. We have, I don't know, 30, 35,000 people on the shelf. Maybe someday we could bring in some citizen volunteers to supervise some of those people that are of so low security risk that all they are name on a piece of paper. I'm saying that half facetiously. It's obvious that we need to have more supervision out there, and we are severely underfunded and understaffed. So what I'm making those comments just to suggest that I've already said we're not having a work session today. I've heard from so many people with differing views on that bill, but I'd invite some conversations to see whether some of these issues can be resolved. In the meantime, we will go into public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and ask counsel to summarize that measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, a person can commit the offense of driving while under the influence of intoxicants, either by driving while under the influence of alcohol, a controlled substance, or a combination of the two. Under current law, a vapor-releasing substance is not included in the list of materials or substances that a person could be under the influence under. What this bill does is to add a vapor-releasing substance, as defined in the bill, to something that a person could be under the influence of in order to commit the crime of driving while under the influence of intoxicants.
All right. Our first witness up is Deborah Downey Gilmore from the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence. Good morning. Whoops, we're already in the public hearing. Welcome to the public hearing.
Good Good morning. My name is Deborah Downey-Gilmore, and I serve as committee staff to the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, and I am here to relay their support of Senate Bill 443-A. Drug-impaired driving in Oregon has become an increasingly serious problem. In 1997, 67 people died as a result of drug-impaired crashes. Since the inception of the Drug Recognition Expert Program for law enforcement officers in Oregon, we've seen a 100% increase in the number of drug-impaired arrests as a result of that training. Those arrested were individuals who in the past would have been released because they did not register a blood alcohol level sufficient to fall under Oregon's legal per se limit of 0.08, or they would be charged with something else, even though they clearly demonstrated signs of impairment and were unable to operate a motor vehicle. Often the first interdiction for a person abusing alcohol and or drugs is law enforcement. And if arrested for DUI as defined in Senate Bill 443-A, these individuals would receive assessment and subsequent treatment and could very well have some positive results of that. Intervention at an early age of abuse can definitely help in interdicting on the addiction process. There are potentially lethal consequences if we don't start taking care of this issue in particular. Drug-impaired driving is a very, very serious issue. The Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI would urge your support of this bill, and they also want to bring to your attention that in 1998, an Intercept survey conducted in Oregon, 94% of those surveyed said that they believe that impaired driving is socially unacceptable behavior. So the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI would definitely ask for your support in this bill. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer those.
Thank you. Representative Bowman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious as to what the level of vapor-releasing substance needs to be in your system. If I sat in my car and sprayed breath spray into my mouth, I would have that substance in my system. Would I then be convicted of DWI because I chose to use breath spray as I was driving down the street?
Chair Mannix and Representative Bowman, I believe that Oregon State Police Officer Lieutenant Chuck Hayes is here and could respond to your question more adequately than I could.
I'm sorry, I didn't listen to the answer.
Mr. Chair, my response was I'm delegating that to someone else because Lieutenant Chuck Hayes of the Oregon State Police, and he is the drug recognition expert coordinator for the state. He is much more adequately prepared to respond to that question.
All right. Thank you very much. You might want to stand by, and we'll call up Mr. Chuck Hayes. Good morning, Lieutenant Hayes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I do have copies of my testimony here. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lieutenant Chuck Hayes, Oregon State Police, also the coordinator for the Drug Evaluation and Classification Program that Deborah Downey-Gilmore was just speaking about. And I would like to echo a couple of things that, that she has mentioned. Since we've started training police officers in the detection of drug-impaired drivers, we've seen over a 100% increase, and those numbers continue to grow. In fact, since the inception of this program in Oregon in 1995, now we have 141 officers that are trained as drug recognition experts throughout the state. And we've trained another 3,000 officers in basic drug-impaired driving detection skills. And since we started this program, we've actually seen that we're encountering drivers that had not been actually detected in the past. And I can think back in my early years in law enforcement where drivers that were under the influence, but yet we didn't have the knowledge or the skills to be able to determine what they were impaired upon. Unfortunately, some of those people were let go because of a lack of training. But now we don't have that happening in Oregon. We actually have officers that know what to do, know what to look for as far as substances other than liquor or our controlled substances. A couple of examples that I'd like to bring to your attention that I have been personally involved in or aware of that some of these are very tragic was a traffic fatality that happened in Clackamas County a few years ago that involved the operator that caused that fatality was inhaling nitrous oxide at the time of that crash. We also had a fatality on Highway 101 just north of Coos Bay years ago that again also involved the driver inhaling nitrous oxide prior to that crash.
Lieutenant Hayes, I'm going to interrupt you and ask you to stand by right there.
I will.
Senator Peter Courtney has arrived. And,
it's always kind of an entrance, isn't it? It's never
I felt something right behind me, sir. I knew that.
Felt this whirlwind.
I mean, this heat was just coming through.
I will gladly remove myself.
Put you on pause for a moment. Senator Courtney. No, Lieutenant, go ahead and stay there. There's enough room.
I'd actually just get out of the way if I were you.
Which one do you want, Kevin, please?
This is 443 on Gallants.
They don't have this one.
Oh, you guys call it vapor-releasing substance.
Yep, it is a Courtney bill.
You know, I've had more trouble with Courtney bills.
Courtney is a bill.
I'm telling you. Doesn't matter which committee I'm sitting in.
Those are personal drugs, so they're not going to see.
Good morning, Senator Courtney. We have your written summary. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Mannix, members of the House Judiciary Criminal Law Committee, good state troopers already started the testimony in Senate Bill 443, which actually did pretty well over in the Senate, although I had to take a dive on the bill to get it out, and I'll explain that to you. It's very depressing to me, but that's
well, we can always fix those things.
Yeah, that's what why I started that way. this committee is demonstrating that it can do things that no other committee can do. You know what's involved here. I don't have to bore you with reading my testimony. I always like to add testimony, but you know what's involved here is that we have drinking and driving laws in the state of Oregon, and we even have a .08 in the state, which I wish was .06, but we have a .08. We were one of the first states to go to .08. I remember when we did that in 1981. And we have a lot of other laws, and we're going to add a lot of laws to drinking and driving, I believe, this session. I think I can say that, Mr. Chair. You know, you've been working very hard on a DUI package and doing very well at it, and this committee is doing very well at it. But what's very interesting is, since 78, I don't know if you said this, if you stole all my testimony, I'm going to be very upset.
I didn't, sir.
That we've had a 65% increase in drug use and inhalants, ranging from Valium to paint thinner, when it comes to people being on the road and being impaired. So while your drinking, driving has somewhat leveled off, when you get to inhalants or drugs, over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs, and I've brought two prescription drugs here, which I really, for personal reason, don't want to show you too closely, but on both of these, it's a warning about drowsiness or combining of alcohol, and this one here, which I don't drive your car. And it says, don't drive the car. And these are drugs that, we'll just simply say that these are drugs that, that have been involved in my life in the last few years, somewhat because of my eye surgery, which I had at the end of 97. And so these are drugs that were in my life. And one of them still is to a certain extent. And I'm not going to get more personal than that because I hope you don't ask me to show you the drugs because that's too personal. But I want you to tell you it's a real thing. But on it is the red label. May cause drowsiness, don't combine with alcohol. And the other one says, don't drive a car.
Does it also say don't take before going on the Senate floor? I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. Mr. Chair, I was wondering if I could ask the witness if these drugs have anything to do with the way this bill was treated over in the Senate.
Well, yes, they do. Both seriously and in a kidding way, yes, they do. And all we've done is to try to do what 35 other states have done, which said, because apparently when you get into the breathalyzers and things, they don't pick up. They don't pick up inhalants, and they don't pick up these drugs. They don't pick them up. And I have to tell you, since 1970s, California had broadened their law. And I know if you're going home tonight, and I know there's at least one member of this committee, and I'm not going to get personal because it's a very traumatic time in his life, and I don't even look at him when I'm saying this. And maybe others, if a loved one is driving their car and somebody comes across the middle stripe coming their way And it's because of something like this, folks, or inhalant, there is dead, if that's what happens, or quadriplegic, if that's what happens, as though they would be if someone had come out of the Ram Pub with alcohol. I mean, it's that serious, folks. It's just that's the way it goes. And so what I'm saying is we would like to broaden the law. I had everything in there. I had these kinds of things in there. California, most of the 35 states had these things in there. I couldn't move the bill. I couldn't move the bill out because the OMA and the pharmaceuticals came in on me like Darth Vader, like a cloud, just opened up on me and said no. So the only thing I could get in the bill were inhalants. And in effect, that's what's in there. And of course, the good state trooper has already documented, so I'm not going to document you, at least several cases where literally they found the individual in the car and they were inhaling and they really had caused a very serious situation. So the bill before you simply says inhalants. Had no trouble getting it out of the Judiciary Committee, no trouble getting out of the House, but when you get into prescription drugs or these kinds of things, they're not in the bill. So in effect, they're still not covered under DUI as I understand it. So that's all I want to say. I didn't read my testimony. I don't like to read testimony. You know that, Chair, but I'd like to leave something with you. And so that's this simple little bill that's before you, and I'd hope you'd seriously consider it, at least get to the inhalant part of it and broaden our law to include that. Because, you know, you have a member of your body that's got an inhalant law, which is coming over, and that involves inhalants by kids. So this inhalant thing is going on. And those kids, by the way, are getting in cars, but they're not the only ones. Some younger adults are inhaling and getting in cars, and they're inhaling, literally, as they're driving their car with a bag over there. They're inhaling. And, folks, that's pretty serious stuff because they're out of control, and they're going 65 miles an hour. And one of these accidents, I know where it took place because it's on the way to Western Oregon University in those roads, that's bad stuff. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my testimony.
Right. And Senator Representative Pruzanski will have a question in a moment. I wanted to mention that we broadened the inhalants bill to include any person, not just children.
Okay.
So that's on its way to the Senate. In fact, it passed yesterday, I believe. It's hard to keep track these
days. A couple
days
ago.
Dave Poulias. Representative Pruzanski has a question.
Yeah, I guess more of a statement for clarification because the law currently does say that besides alcohol-controlled substances, are in fact already covered by under the law. So depending on the pharmaceutical medicine that you may have, if it's within the controlled substance schedules, it would in fact be covered. It's true that you would not be able to prove or detect through the intoxilizer, but that's why I think what Lieutenant Hayes is talking about, the DREs, these are individuals that are in fact trained to be able to make certain recognitions of individuals that are under the influence of a different intoxicants. Now, if that's not correct, I'd like to know that because that's the way I've always interpreted controlled substances. If it's something that is a controlled substance, it can, if it can be proven in a court of law, that it's one is a controlled substance and two that they did in fact impair their driving ability to a noticeable perceptual degree, mental or physically. That they could, in fact, be charged and convicted of that crime.
Well, Chair Max, Representative Pruzanski, your committee needs to look at that because that's not what was being done before the Senate Judiciary Committee. You're in an area now that's got me confused because you're saying that these drugs are covered already by the DUI laws of the state of Oregon.
Well, I'm not sure what schedule they are, but if they're controlled substances, unless I've got a different definition I've been working for years, a controlled substance, if you're under the influence of that when you're driving a motor vehicle, not only can you be charged, you can, in fact, be convicted if it can be proven.
I think Lieutenant Hayes can confirm that.
Chair Mannix and Representative Pruzanski, you're correct. The way the law is structured now, if it is proven to be a controlled substance and on the controlled substance list, then yes, we can convict someone for DUII. Where we're running into problems is, and you're very, very familiar with that controlled substance list, is that there are many, many substances that have impairing effects that are not on the controlled substance list. In fact, we have seen just in the last 3 or 4 months, 4 or 5 new depressants that have been added, and they're now available to people that have impairing effects that if they were under the influence of that, such as butalbital, which is very popular, and it's an antidepressant that is being used, and we find drivers driving under the influence of that, we cannot charge that person with DUI because it's not on the controlled substance list.
Mr. Chair, I just want to put that on the record that we do have something already in place, and I understand how we want to broaden it, and I support that because no matter what the substance is, being on the controlled substance list or not, it's impairing someone's ability to drive a motor vehicle, we know that that can, in fact, be a deadly weapon.
Most definitely.
Now, Senator, Senator, are you suggesting you want us to take another look? One issue that we note is that we wonder if inhalant wouldn't be a better approach here rather than vapor-releasing substance. We're wondering if we shouldn't parallel the language here to the inhalant bill so that there's some similarity, and actually that would broaden perhaps some of the substances here. Or should we just leave this alone and see what happens for a couple of years?
I think you should go for what you think you can get. You may find out in a few minutes. I don't know who's sitting behind me, but I think
John May's not here.
Well,
yet.
That's interesting. I'm just being very frank with you, who opposed the bill. Now, they didn't do it in the inhalant area. They did it in the drug area, to be very frank with you. I didn't run into trouble with the inhalant situation. So right. If you can broaden that inhalant to be more consistent with other bills, and probably I think you should do that. If we get into troubles, then we'll get into troubles with the conference committee or something like that, I guess.
Well, we'll see what we can do. Representative Bowman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to your last comment, we are going to run into problems if we expand it to inhalants, because that includes lots of substances that are legal to buy and legal to use, and that's kind of like the question I asked at the beginning. Well, what if I'm riding down the street and I spray breath spray in my mouth, as far as if it would be in my system? So if you tested me, you would know I had sprayed breath spray, but how do you figure out what's the limit on breath spray?
Well, I think the breath spray has alcohol in it. That's the main thing, unless it's the mint.
Well, you know, when we had all the conversation with about the inhalant bill, we understood how broad that inhalant policy is. But it's a big difference when you're talking about charging somebody with DWI.
And you're right, Representative Bowman. In fact, what we chose to do there was have a broad range of substances, but then emphasize with the intent to become intoxicated. So we had a broad range of substances, but a narrow range of intent. Here you probably want to have, the idea that you're driving, you're under the influence. Obviously, you ingested something or you allowed yourself to take in something, but you probably want to have a narrower range so that we avoid problems in that. But I'll also ask Lieutenant Taylor, is it Lieutenant Taylor?
Lieutenant Hayes.
Excuse me, Hayes, mm-hmm. To comment on that. Senator Courtney, if it's all right, we'll have Lieutenant Hayes pick up on his testimony, and I understand you're going to testify on another bill?
Yes, that's Senate Bill 506. That's
if you'd like, I can recess, and we can move to that if you need to get back over to the Senate.
Well, I'll just leave my testimony. If you would, I'll just take I keep my word.
For the record.
I have long testimony, but I will not.
Pause for a moment. For the record, we will recess. Well, Senator, okay, you do have the testimony. We'll recess the hearing on Senate Bill 443 and convene the public hearing on Senate Bill
506.
So we are in public hearing on Senate Bill 506. Senator Courtney.
The genesis of this bill, thank you, Chair Maddox, and members of the committee, Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 17. This is another bill that is, in effect, adding on to an existing bill. We passed a minor in possession bill, which involved revoking or denying a minor their driver's license if they were found in possession of alcohol. Apparently what's happened, though, is under the current law, a minor caught in possession is supposed to lose their driver's license for a year or until their 17th birthday, whichever is longer. That would be the situation where a kid doesn't have his or her license yet and wants to get it, or a kid who does have it. So it applies to both situations. However, in reality, fewer than 50% of the minors caught with alcohol lose their licenses. And simply because this is a result of lack of enforcement. We believe this is sending the wrong message to children. As I understand it, last year there were 5,700 youths between the ages of 13 and 17 who were arrested for possessing alcohol, but only 2,600 had their license suspended. This bill attempts to correct that. And let me just say, it's my understanding of what's going on here is the kid who gets cited into court or into a hearing. If they don't show up at the hearing, in which it's in their best interest not to, nothing happens to them because they'd have to issue an arrest or a warrant to go out and arrest them. They don't do that, so in effect, the kid gets away. It's on a record of some kind, but the kid doesn't get his license suspended, and that's exactly what's happening right here and now. And so that accounts for why so many of these kids, while they're arrested and found to have this possession of alcohol, they simply don't appear for the hearing, and as a result, they go scot-free, unless they would be somehow or other arrested for something else, and they bring them in the court and say, hey, wait a minute, you didn't show up for that hearing, let's get into that. All this bill does, it says, it warns the kid, you don't show up for that hearing, you don't show up for that hearing, your license is gone. Now, if they do show up for the hearing, I want you to understand their license is not necessarily gone. They are immediately going to be evaluated to find out if they have a drinking problem, or if they don't have a drinking problem, they'll be put into an education program. But if they do have a drinking problem, they will put it into some kind of alcohol treatment program, in which both cases, their license suspension can be varied accordingly. So all this basically does is tighten up a law that we passed years ago, which, by the way, was recommended by a class out of Ashland. I was there the day on the Judiciary Committee when I think it was an Ashland Middle School came up with the idea, why don't you try driver's licenses to minors in possession? This was not an adult bill, and we did it. The problem is we didn't do it in a way that's really strong. So that's all this bill does. It says, okay, you've got to come to this hearing, minor in possession. You don't come to that hearing, and your license is gone. Whereas today, if they don't come to the hearing, their license isn't necessarily gone. Now, conceivably, law enforcement officials, if they issued a warrant, went out and got the kid, arrested him, brought him in, that's one thing. But resources-wise and everything, you can see, 5,700 versus 2,600, the law simply isn't functioning as we want it to work. So that's all it does, Mr. Chair. This one went pretty good in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Again, I learned this. Is it a perfect bill? I don't know. I know this committee will carefully evaluate this bill along with your learned counsel and decide whether or not it needs more work or not. But that's this bill. I think it's an important bill because we do want to get into kids' lives that have a drinking problem, or if they don't, we want to get into lives and tell them how important it is that they understand the dangers of alcohol. And one of the ways to do it is with the license, but we also got to get them into the hearing to make sure that takes place. So that's quickly, in a nutshell, without reading my testimony, what 506 does.
All right, thank you, Senator Courtney. Rosenbaum has a question.
Thank you. Senator Courtney, this bill does not specify who would pay the cost if the parent and youth are not able to pay the cost of the examination and the program. What was your intention in this bill?
The public would pick up the cost. That question came up. And we said that.
Does it say that in the bill?
No, it doesn't. But I mean, I didn't say it in the bill. But I mean, that question came up, and that's how we responded to it. But it doesn't say it necessarily in the bill. I don't believe it does.
I didn't see it there either.
I mean, I'm going through all my notes in the bill, but that question did come up. The parents are supposed to pay for it. The kid can't pay for it, but we assume the public would pick up the costs as they do in many of these types of programs, to be very frank. And that's, by the way, a resource issue, too. I won't deny that. That's one of the problems we're having now. So,
well, as I understand it, there's a provision for some of these other programs where those who can afford to pay a certain fee, and then that fee goes into a fund, and then that fund is available to pay for those who can't afford to pay. And we may hear some testimony on that, so we should keep, because I note that at page 1 of the A and Gross Senate Bill 506, section 2, sub 2, the youth or parents or guardian of the youth shall pay all costs associated with the examination and rehabilitation or alcohol information program ordered by a court under the section, which lines 16 through 18. But we'll probably hear that while that says that, there's also this funded program for those who can't afford to pay. Usually there's generic legislation about those who can't afford to pay can't be forced through this, sort of like indigent defense. But we'll clarify that point before we proceed.
I'm glad you brought it up, though, because, you know, we pass these laws and say the kid pays and the family pays. The truth of the matter is we never got situations out there where neither one pays. So what do we do? Just simply don't bring the kid in? And that's not what we want to do. So I think.
But we'll try to make sure we will make sure we've covered that question. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you for indulging me. I appreciate it very much.
We'll recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 506 and reconvene the hearing on Senate Bill 443. Lieutenant Hayes, we had you in the midst of your testimony. Let me ask you a question. I think that we may be able to get to closure fairly quickly on this if I detect the sense of the committee. Lieutenant Hayes, I assume that the list here was developed in a fairly limited fashion in order to be careful about what's being covered in terms of driving under the influence legislation. Were you involved in this development of this list or aware of it?
Chair Mannix, yes, I was. And you're speaking of the inhalants and those particular vapor-releasing substances.
And
yes.
Should we continue with that phraseology as opposed to inhalants in order to distinguish this from the other legislation dealing with inhalants?
Chair Mannix, I believe so, because that list covers what substances that we know of right now that are causing the majority, if not all, of the impairment of those type of substances. We're trying to stay away from some of the issues that Representative Bowman addressed about Banaca spray and those type of things as well. So those substances right there are the most common, frequently abused, that have been shown to cause impairment when ingested into the human body.
Representative Gianella has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Lieutenant, on page 3 of your testimony, second paragraph, says, however, the driver was intoxicated on Cava Cava after drinking 13 cups of the non-controlled substance. What is that?
Chair Mannix and Representative Gianella, Cava Cava is a natural herb that is now being produced and sold widely throughout the United States and here in Oregon, and it is a relaxant. And we have found that if people use that in proper form, and it is produced in a capsule that you can buy in a health food store, and if you take it the way that it is produced and meant to be taken, there's no difficulties or no problems that will be generated there. But we've had two particular cases in Oregon that the DREs have been involved in where two male subjects actually ingested 13 to 15 cups of this tea that was produced from the Cava Cava plant. And in both of these cases, the general public was reporting these two drivers as drunk drivers. They were literally running people off the road. The officers made the stop, found out that that's what was causing the impairment was a Cava Cava. And we have one of them is on videotape, and this person can literally not stand up to perform field sobriety tests being given by the police officer. And that's what it was. And it came back as Cava Cava in the urine, and therefore we cannot charge this person with DUI. Neither one of those have been charged with DUI. The cases were dismissed against both of those drivers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is that, okay. Lieutenant, is that sold in a grocery store in like a replacement for coffee or in a health food store? Is that the
I have not seen it as, Chair Mannix and Representative Gianella, I have not seen that as a replacement to coffee. It's being marketed and manufactured as possibly a natural type of stress reliever or depressant, and some people are using it for the calming effect. And again, like with so many prescription medications and non-controlled medications, if people use them the way that they're supposed to be used and not over-medicate themselves or abuse them, well, then they're not going to be in trouble. But yet, in these two particular cases that I've documented here, that's what happened. The drivers just totally over-medicated themselves to the point of intoxication, and they knew they were intoxicating themselves and took their chances.
Lieutenant, we do have the rest of your written testimony. Was there anything you wanted to add to that?
No, if I just could clarify just a couple of things, would be that when we originally looked at this bill, as Senator Courtney said, we were looking at other substances. And all I can say is that it all comes down to intoxication or impairment. A person that just takes a couple of breaths of Banaca and gets that residual of the alcohol content of Banaca is not going to be impaired. It all comes down to the officer and especially the drug recognition expert. And whether the person's impaired on Prozac or Valium or Xanax or phenobarbital or whatever the prescription may be, some of those are controlled and some of those are non-controlled. And so we just feel with the Oregon State Police that we're trying to do the best we can to improve highway safety and transportation safety. And that if a person's impaired or they're intoxicated on a substance, whether it be alcohol or a controlled substance or non-controlled, such as a vapor-releasing substance, they should all be treated the same, and they should be charged with DUI and not having arrest being dismissed because the law does not support that.
All right. Thank you very much, Lieutenant.
Thank you very much.
Representative Przanski, well, I'll first ask, are there any other witnesses here on Senate Bill 443? All right, seeing none, before we close the public hearing, Representative Przanski, can you indicate some desire to take a look at some of these?
Mr. Chair, I thought we were talking about maybe either expanding this list and or redefining the vapor releasing as inhalants or something.
I started out being tempted to do that, but then I heard Representative Bowman's concern that we're talking about Of course, the answer, I guess, can also be it's the question is impairment or intoxication.
That is the question. I mean, it's not really what you...
So if you would like, I'd welcome holding us over a few days to take a look at that list and see if we could deal with a broader range of impairing substances. Are you comfortable with that, members? Let's plan on setting this perhaps for next Thursday for a work session. And Lieutenant Hayes, not Taylor, perhaps you can keep in touch with committee counsel and Representative Krasanski. We're going to take a look at that inhalants list from the inhalants bill that the House passed and see if we could put that into this bill without harming the bill and perhaps helping it. And we'll also thank Deborah Gilmore for being here this morning. We'll conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and again schedule that for work session next Thursday if all things go well. We'll move back to the recessed hearing on Senate Bill 506 and call up. Where's my list? Well, I do know that we've got Sergeant Kurt Curtis here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, witness is coming up. Is there a relationship between this and the legislation we passed last week that would reassign cases back to juvenile court from municipal court if they fail to appear?
I don't know.
Nor do I. Mr. Chair, it doesn't seem like it would be broad enough because of what I remember from the original bill that we put in, we had minor property, tobacco, and I thought alcohol was in the original bill that became law, and this one is basically giving the same or looking at the same issues and just allowing or making certain that the juvenile court can, in fact, bring these youth back into its system.
Well, in fact, as we're getting into this, I see Deborah Downey-Gilmore. I'll ask her to come back up, too, and sit with you, Sergeant. Right. And Bob Miller from the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, if you would come up, please. We'll have the three of you up here. And so I've got Sergeant Curtis, Deborah Downey-Gilmore, and Bob Miller. I also will be calling up later Kelly Taylor and Kathy Osborne. Our members do know the agenda ahead of time, so they have a chance to peruse these bills. I should have had counsel summarize the bill. Why don't we have you do that quickly, just to bring everybody up to speed?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 506 has to do with situations in which a younger person, a person under 21, either acquires or attempts to acquire alcohol. And what the bill does is allows the court to direct the DMV to suspend the driver's license or deny the right to receive a driver's license to a person under 18. For a period of 1 year, if the person acquires or attempts to acquire alcohol and either fails to appear in court after being ordered by the court to do so on that charge or fails to attend a treatment or education program pursuant to being ordered by the court to do so because of that attempted minor in possession or minor in possession.
Now, colleagues, again, I have a chance to look at these things ahead of time. I don't know what kind of comfort level folks get. I also look at the witness list. The one person who has a neutral is Kelly Taylor. I've got Kathy Osborne as in favor and everybody else in favor on this bill. And what I'd like to do is ask each of you to sort of cut to the chase about the issues as you see them. And, Sergeant, I'm going to ask you to stand by and let Deborah Downey-Gilmore go first.
Good morning, Chair Mannix and members of the committee. I'm Deborah Downey-Gilmore, and I serve as committee staff to the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. Of particular concern to the committee is the overrepresentation of youth under age 21 in fatal and injury crashes as a result of alcohol. Alcohol continues to be the overwhelming drug of choice for youth. Nearly 65% of Oregon 11th graders surveyed reported alcohol use in the past year, and I believe Mr. Miller could address that more specifically as the report was pulled together through his office. Presently, courts have a very limited set of options when a youth who has been cited for MIP fails to appear on that citation. Many of these youths have also been issued a driver's license within the last 18 months, and
the combination of any level of alcohol in the system of a very youthful, inexperienced driver is often proven to be a very deadly one. What we would like to see is youth held accountable for their actions as a committee, and this bill provides the assessment and treatment necessary for addressing the alcohol and drug abuse problems that these youth are possibly under the influence of, and the Governor's Advisory Committee definitely supports Senate Bill 506-A.
Great.
Thank you.
Sergeant, did you want to add some comments?
If I could, just that we are in support, and Chair Mannix, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police, and we come here today in support of this Senate Bill 506-A. We believe that early intervention is necessary to help deter the drug and drinking driver problem that we have in the state, and the earliest that we can get in is the best, and I'm not going to go through similar testimony that Deborah Downey just given, just that we're here in support.
Very good. Mr. Miller?
Chair Mannix, members of the committee, my name is Bob Miller. I'm operations manager for the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. However, I do have two suggestions about how the bill could be improved, or at least two issues that need to be looked at. One is the issue that was discussed earlier during Senator Courtney's testimony, and that's for those clients who are unable to pay, how do we ensure that the resources are there for them to access the information programs or the treatment programs that are required by this bill? If the governor's budget for our agency is approved, we would have additional resources to implement this bill and also implement a range of other improved or increased services. If not, then the bill would require us to ensure that there are treatment or information resources for the clients that are going to be referred through this process, but the bill does not provide any additional resources. Right now, our resources, our treatment resources, are stretched to the limit, so I believe that we would have difficulty implementing what the bill intends.
So what we need is a phrase here on page 1 after lines 16 through 18 that basically says, if the youth or parents or guardian are unable to afford, that the cost should be borne by your office to the extent that resources are available. If your office advises that resources are not available, then the program cannot be required unless some other resource is identified, or some sort of language to have the court make sure that for the person who can't afford the program, some resource has been identified to pay for the program, or else they shouldn't be requiring the program.
Another option would be to put something in the bill that would allow us to access some other funds, such as the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund.
If you can work that out, bring up some language that will let you do that, and it'll work, and we won't screw up the other operations, that'll be fine. Can you work on some language to that extent?
Certainly.
All right.
I just have a quick question. Currently, if someone is in the diversion program, they get top priority for treatment beds, and also if they cannot afford to pay it, then the court provides for that payment. I'm just wondering why this would not, we couldn't include this in the rules that we use for the diversion program. I would think that if our goal is to get youth into alcohol treatment, that that would ensure that they would move to the top of the list for a treatment program space.
Do you have a response to that, anybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I think what I was just suggesting is that we do just that, that we amend this bill to so that these clients would have access to the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, which is similar to what DUI offenders have.
Let's do this then. Does anyone else have questions for these three witnesses?
Mr. Chair,
they
may want to comment. I believe there may be some direct conflict between this bill and House Bill 2705 that Representative Krasanski worked on and I worked on, where the language in Section 2 indicates that if they have a youth who is subject to 471.430, which is the MIP statute, I believe, relates to possession of alcohol by someone under 21, the court shall order the youth to undergo an examination.
And the language we came to Representative Przanski and did was a may on the first offense and a shall on the second offense to try to reduce the cost a little bit. And that bill is on its way to the Senate.
That's 2775.
2705.
2705. What I'll ask you to do, Mr. Miller, if you would take a look at the language of that bill, would you, Deborah Downey Gilmore, be the person who would be sort of another key person to work with on a work group on this?
I would be happy to do that, yes.
All right. And what I'd like to ask you to take a look at 2705, see how that melds in with this and what Mr. Miller was talking about. Sergeant, do you want to be involved in that discussion too, or just watching the amendments?
We'd be happy to support in any way that we can, Chair Mannix.
I've also got Kathy Osborne here in support, and then I see Kelly Taylor from ODOT Neutral probably raising a technical question. Can I ask you, the three of you, to stand down for a moment? We'll pull up Kathy Osborne and Kelly Taylor and see where we can go with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. We are in support of this bill, and other than telling you, going into any further detail, what I'll do is answer some of the questions that other representatives have brought up. In answering Representative Simmons' bill about 2705, I believe this is the number, Hospital 2705, I don't think there is a conflict. 2705, my understanding of that, I haven't really followed it because my understanding was it was limited to 18 to 21-year-olds who were found within the jurisdiction or found guilty on an MIP. This bill relates to only youth. So in other words, the definition of youth is in the juvenile code someone who's under 18. So those two bills could be seen together as covering the whole spectrum between however young and 21. And when we were working on this bill over on the Senate side, we talked about whether it should be a shall or a may, and because of the concern of wanting to make sure that the juveniles who are under 18, who were found within the jurisdiction of the court on an MIP for alcohol, were getting alcohol, at least an alcohol evaluation. That was why the decision was made to make it a shall. In answering Representative Hansen's questions about how this would work with Senate Bill 75, I believe it is, 78, sorry, in terms of the waiver, although that bill allows for waiver of youth to adult court, youth that are charged with the violation of MIP for alcohol are not traditionally waived to adult court. Those are the kids that actually juvenile courts want to deal with. One of the problems for juvenile courts is because of the lack of resources, the MIPs, the juveniles who are charged with MIP alcohol, aren't getting as much court notice that they probably should. I don't believe 78 covers the violations. I know that Silverton is the only municipality right now and has been the only municipality that has waived juveniles to adult court for the property offenses, for the misdemeanor property offenses that bill covers. And in speaking to the Silverton people and also Larry Oglesby regarding Senate Bill 78, they assured us that MIP alcohol kids would not be waived into adult court because they want to keep those kids in juvenile court.
Now, I've got Kelly Taylor here. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation.
I've got your written testimony.
Yes, I'm going to cut to the chase. When we look at this bill, trying to see how it would be in real life, applying it to people, and I'm looking at page 10, section 5, that's the piece that hits us. I just want to point out a couple of things.
Cost, money, too early implementation date, need to worry about some of the technical details.
Correct, because you're treating people differently depending on their driving status and driver license.
So we need a work group to refine this.
Correct.
And if you would participate in that work group with Mr. Miller, and by the way, Kathy Osborne, you're welcome to participate too. We'd welcome that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly would like to, since I have been working on this bill over on the Senate side.
Please. Then if you would work, Kelly Taylor, Kathy Osborne, Kurt Curtis, Deborah Downey Gilmore, and Bob Miller. Yes.
One other piece. I just want to make it clear that this is a may for the courts. It's not a shall. And so it in no way says that the 28,000 kids that get MIPs are actually going to end up suspended. Today the statute says shall, we get a fraction of them. So I just want people to have realistic expectations of what will happen after this bill passes.
Nancy Miller's saying it says shall, but it says may on line 21.
It says
21.
May.
All right. Nancy Miller, while they're still here, come on up. This thing's going to need a work group. The committee is, from what I all the vibes I pick up, positively inclined, but we want a work group to come back with all these rough edges sanded down. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Nancy Miller for the State Court Administrator's Office. Very briefly, I missed an issue in the Senate. I apologize. We'll need one little amendment on the second page that talks about the court can proceed to jurisdiction if the youth does not appear. It needs to say after a prima facie showing. So we would be happy to participate in the work group also. One other quick issue, if we start talking about courts making determinations about who can pay and who can't pay, I'm a little concerned about the fiscal at that point. There are a lot of these cases, and if we're making these kind of determinations and have to do verification of income, we're going to need to relook at the fiscal. So
well,
we're
well,
happy
I'll
to look at the wording.
The work group should note the prima facie case language requirement, and what I'll ask them to do is to contact you to when they've got a rough of some amendments, see if there's some fiscal on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
And I would ask Deborah Downey-Gilmore to serve as the coordinator of the work group. If she, or do you have someone else to suggest? I'd like to have a lead person that we can look to get back to us within a week, I hope, with some suggestions, and then we'll set this for a work session. In the meantime, if any of the members have specific questions, let John Horton know, and we'll try to pass them on, and we'll go from there.
Thank you.
Representative Fasansky.
Just curiosity, is someone from the committee, either staff or us, going to be involved?
Would you like to be involved with this?
I want to know when it's happening. I've
got
some concerns. I just want to make sure they're addressed.
Likewise, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Simmons and Representative Fasansky need to be kept in the loop. And that's for Deborah Downey-Gilmore. Keep Representative Fasansky and Representative Simmons, in the loop on this. Very well. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 506? Seeing none, the public hearing is closed on Senate Bill 506. We were in recess on the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. We will reconvene the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. I do have a couple of witnesses from further away that I'm going to call up first. Roland from Deschutes County. I can't quite read the last. Sorry. Okay, come on up. And I guess Elise Clausen signed up with you, so come on up together. If you have someone else you want up.
Not you.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Elise Clausen. I'm the director of the Department of Community Justice in Multnomah County, but I'm actually here representing the statewide Community Corrections Association. We are here to talk about Senate Bill 686 and what we hope will be proposed amendments that we believe Representative Hansen will propose. We're strongly urging you to pass this legislation and support this legislation. This is a legislation about community corrections, and it is really to support what is largely current practice in this state. It is to provide assistance to parole and probation officers and to do that at their direction. We really need parole and probation officers in this state. They are the foundation of our business. We do not in any way want to dilute or reduce or take away from their duties or their authority. But we clearly need them to provide close supervision to those offenders who provide the greatest risk to our community members. On my way down here, I was thinking of an analogy in medicine. Doctors are clearly the most highly trained professionals in the medical community. But can you imagine what the cost of care would be and the kind of care in a hospital if the only person who could make patient contact of any kind was a physician? And that's the kind of thing we're talking about here with parole and probation officers. in this bill, with the proposed amendments, it clearly delineates those duties which are only parole and probation officers' duties, and they need to do those, and no one else is trained or able to do those. But it also allows for paraprofessionals and others to support them, to do things like urinalysis, to make a telephone call at their request, or to receive a telephone call, to do some clerical kinds of functions, all of which assist parole and probation officers. In our county, we have been able to allow parole and probation officers to more closely supervise the most dangerous offenders in our community and those who present the greatest risk even of other kinds of crime. And as a result of that, we're implementing more sanctions for violations because we're finding those violations more quickly than we ever have before. I would also say that if this legislation were not to pass, that then parole and probation officers around the state would have to pick up the kinds of duties that other staff are assisting them with, which would significantly reduce the supervision to those offenders who pose the greatest risk to our community. And I think that is a public safety problem in our state. If, in fact, those positions were converted to parole and probation officers, at least in our county and I think other counties, we're talking about a 30% increase in cost, not including retirement. So it's a significant fiscal issue as well as a public safety issue, and we think this makes good public safety sense as well as good fiscal sense.
Let me stop you for a second.
Sure.
I've got a couple of questions. I guess I'm not sure why the legislation is here. It seems to me that you already have staff that support staff for P&P. And to me, I guess if we're looking at having people assist P&P officers already, why do we need to put in another piece of legislation or law that is going to, I mean, I'm not sure what they can't do now that we have to put in the statute.
I'll try to explain that, Representative Probansky. There was a lawsuit in Washington County some years ago and then recently in Multnomah County because the previous legislation that was passed that outlines parole and probation officer duties, I think passed in 1977, is very generic. And under the lawsuit in Multnomah County and in Washington County, it said that, in fact, paraprofessionals could not do what is current practice throughout the state. And in fact, the judge in his judgment said that he thought that it was probably poor public policy and that it needed to be revisited by the legislature, which is one of the reasons we are here.
Is that case reported?
Yes, that case is reported, and actually, I may have a copy of his comments with me, which I'd be happy to provide to you, that was in his initial judgment. And so what we're doing in this piece of legislation is trying to clarify those duties which only a certified parole and probation officer can do, and then provide the ability under a parole and probation officer's direction to be able to do some other kinds of routine tasks.
Is this case on appeal?
No, it is not on appeal at this. It likely will go on appeal, but it's not on appeal at this point. In fact, I think the judge has not rendered his final judgment, but he did find. I actually have it probably here.
Yeah, for the committee, I've been handed a piece of paper that talks about footnotes and conclusions of an opinion from the Appeals Circuit Court out of Monona County, dated January 20th of this year. Mm. So it's something very new.
Excuse me, Mr. Vice Chair. I think we also had this legislation last session, and did we just run out of time because it was towards the end?
It did not come back before the committee. We were asked to go work out some agreements with the union. We've made an effort to do that, and it did not end up being reheard in the committee. We've also been talking with representatives from the union just now. We would ask you to support the proposed amendments that we're going to bring forward, and in some of the issues that the Parole and Probation Officer Union is asking here, we have conceptual agreement with many of those. A couple of those we don't, but we do have many of them.
I'm going to see if we can kind of cut to the chase here, because we're supposed to be on the floor in 10 minutes. I can tell you that this is not going to move today.
Right.
There's enough, let's say, need for discussion from both perspectives that we're going to need to have some type of work group put together. And so I know there's a number of people that are here, and I'd like to have them have an opportunity also to be placing whatever they want to on the record now. So if you could kind of wrap up
And then what we'll do is I expect we'll have some type of work group put together so we can have this. In response to Representative Bowman, if I remember correctly, this bill last time was being heard on July 4th, the wee hours of the morning.
I thought so, yeah.
Actually, in my office. So
okay.
It didn't get done.
I would turn over the remainder of the time to Roland Gangstry.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair, if I could ask just one question before this, before Elise leaves. I wanted to know if the amendments included notification of sexual predators and other sexual offenders. Is that going to be part of the amendments that would just be parole and probation officer responsibility?
It is not in the proposed amendments that we have put forward as an association, but we would be open to that.
Thank you.
For the record, Mr. Vice Chair and representatives, my name is Roland Gangsty. I'm the Adult Division Manager for Deschutes County Community Justice, and here speaking, representing the Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors, and speaking in support of 686 and the proposed amendments that I think are listed as A6 that Representative Hansen, I believe, is going to be introducing. Since we're wanting to cut to the chase, I'll just say that to underscore one of the many positive things that Elise said, that this basically codifies what has been the practice in virtually every parole and probation office in the state. And it apparently fell to some problematic problems in Washington County that resulted in the court injunction that's been referenced. Most of us are utilizing the services of paraprofessionals in areas that really, we believe, enhance public safety, that enable POs to continue to be out in the field doing what they do best and what they should be doing by statute. In no way is this bill intended to undermine their authority or their responsibilities. It simply gives us an ability to manage our resources as effectively as we can on behalf of the community. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. I guess the other thing is, let's see. We will. You may want to stay here until we get through this to find out how this work group is going to be established and when they're going to be meeting.
Sure.
So thank you. What I'd like to do, I'm looking at the list of who's still here. It looks like everyone else that signed up is in opposition. I have, looks like one individual, Tracy, is it?
Cleano.
Who's in for, are you in from Portland?
I work from Oregon County and Oregon.
Okay, is there anyone else here that was scheduled to testify that's taken time off or here from their job that's not here normally in Salem? Okay. Well, I'm going to have you come up for sure. And let's see, Jennifer Cameron? And are you here locally or? Okay. And let's see. Tracy, come on up. Is it Lucinda? Carol?
Yes.
And are you here locally? I just want to make sure we get people that are out of town.
I'm taking vacation, but I'll take all day.
Yeah, well, you need to come up because we're not going to be here all day. We're only going to be here for maybe 15 more minutes. So. Okay, well, Brian, I may put him over. That's because Brian can come back at another time if we get a call. And let's see, Paul Frank, a citizen, is it Monroe County?
Yes.
Okay, and if you'd like to come up, be ready to come up next. Okay, we'll start with Tracy, please.
My name's Tracy Pugliano. I'm a resident of Multnomah County, and I'm currently employed by the Multnomah County Community Corrections Department as a paraprofessional. I live in the Northeast Portland area, in the same area that I work in, and I work with a specialized domestic violence unit. I won't go into all the details. You have a bio of what I do at work, but my corrections tech job enhances, I believe, the safety of my community because I do a lot of interaction with SCF, with the public schools, with other agencies like aging services, as a sort of a total approach to dealing with domestic violence offenders, because you can't just deal with the offender in these situations. You have to deal with the entire family, because the children and the spouses and girlfriends are all very impacted by it. And these are things that I can do as a support role to a probation officer, that there's no way the probation officer could do all the phone calling and networking and outreach work that I do as a part of these cases and still be able to go out in the field and arrest people. And I want to make it really clear that I don't do any of those things. I don't assist on arrests. I don't go out in the field. My work is primarily office-based, much of it done over the telephone, and I attend a lot of community meetings, domestic violence steering committee meetings. I am very involved in the community, the whole community model of monitoring domestic violence offenders. We have a lot of clients who are stalkers, and they're just very visible in the community, and I think having as many people in the probation department that are able to be receptive to calls from victims and other concerned agencies just enhances the community safety, because we can respond more quickly rather than relying on one probation officer who may have multiple cases that are blowing up at the same time. There are other people in the unit that can do sometimes clerical type tasks, sometimes paraprofessional type tasks that can enhance that supervision. And I take a lot of pride in my work. I have a 4-year college degree. I have a lot of experience in the criminal justice system. I worked as a legal assistant. And so I think that you have a really talented group of people that also know that they're not probation and parole officers, but they still choose to do this work for whatever other reasons. And I think that the community really benefits from the enhanced supervision on these types of cases.
Thank you very much. And I want to put on the record, I apologize. I said that everyone else that was going to be speaking was speaking against. Tracy is for the bill. Thank you. Okay.
My name is Lucinda Carroll, and I'm from the great rural area of Aurora, Representative Gianella's area. And I have been a probation parole officer for 15 years. I am also the chair of the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and I'm here representing the thoughts of those probation parole officers. It did sound to me like in the hallway we were close to agreements on some of these amendments on this bill, on some of the areas that probation and parole officers felt strongly about. There was one area we have grave concerns about that I'm not sure we were close to an agreement, and that is one-on-one contact in the office with paraprofessionals. Our concerns with that is when it's done on a consistent basis, our low and limited risk offenders today were our medium and highs of yesterday. And I've got a list today of what offenses are on those low and limited caseloads that would be taken over by paraprofessionals and were taken over by paraprofessionals prior to our lawsuit. We're talking about murders, arsonists, burglars, thieves, some very serious crimes, and some very serious violations were going on, which was a result of our lawsuit, our concerns over that. So our main concern right now is the one-on-one office visits with offenders, that they're not done on a regular basis, they're not done on a consistent basis, and they're not done by a probation parole officer that is a team leader with considered a supervisor saying, well, okay, I'm going to direct my paraprofessionals to meet with these 300 cases for the next year. And I guarantee you, if that's not put in there, that will happen.
Mr. Chair.
President Brzezinski.
As I said, the chair was out of the room. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know yet that y'all have been talking, and so it's kind of like inside baseball.
Right.
I think instead of getting the really
the great detail of the work, okay, it'd be better for y'all to get together in this work group, so we can see and we can conceptually grasp, because we're piecemealing at this point, which,
right,
you know, I think we need some more substance to actually be able to do it.
And what we want to do, Representative Bowman, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to ask the question, what's the average workload of a parole probation officer, caseload?
On a low and limited, medium and high?
Across the board.
Low and limited can consist anywhere from 150. Right now we have two POs carrying 350 DUI offenders each. And it's ironic because I've spent a lot of time with those POs lately helping them, but they file mounds of paperwork a day, log in 30 to 60 phone calls a day. They have begged for a paraprofessional to help them. We have blessed the department to hire them a paraprofessional for the past 3 years, and their response is, well, it's not a good use of their time. So So they've allowed a PO to do that for 3 years. So it's ironic to us today to be here to...
Would you answer the other part? Low and limited?
The medium and high caseloads in Washington County average anywhere from 80 to 100 cases, and those are considered the medium and high-risk offenders.
Would you see this, and I'll ask all three witnesses to think about this, would you see this legislation as an opportunity for us to revisit from the perspective both of the administrators but also the professional parole and probation officers, how we're approaching the issues in this system? And I'm concerned about Mr. DeLashman's been in, I've talked to Mary Botkin, I've talked to some other folks from a variety of perspectives about the workload issues. And first of all, we want people to be able to maintain their membership status in a labor organization. But second of all, we want people to be able to maintain a decent workload where they feel that they're getting the job done and providing security to the community. Third, we want to try to help the communities keep costs down. And I made a reference to Japan and the volunteerism there, and it may be that some of these more marginal caseloads that aren't really getting supervised might be handled by some organized system of volunteers someday if we authorize that, where it's agreed that we're talking about, say, a first offender who is on probation, and I'm really talking about people you never see again, that I think really deserves some attention just to make sure that everything's copacetic. That would take a whole review of the system, and I'm not pretending that in the next couple of weeks we're going to do that. But if we could at least set the stage for that by being careful with this legislation and making sure that there's the flexibility that some administrators may need, but we recognize the professionalism and the need for the professionalism with the parole and probation officers. Because I'll tell you where we're not going. Where we're not going is to have a parolee who needs professional supervision getting non-professional supervision. At the other end of the extreme, I've got the first-time probationer who's a piece of paper. And maybe someday we could have a system where even that person gets a home visit from a trained volunteer who works under the supervision of a parole and probation officer. And you move your way up where you then may have a paraprofessional working with as part of a team with a parole and probation officer who is, and that parole and probation officer has all the training and certification but has someone with lesser skills but certain skills to share the workload under the direction but not supervision. I know we don't want to get folks away from their membership status. These are the kinds of things we ought to be thinking about, and now I'll shut up and ask you to comment on what I just said.
I understand what you're saying, Representative Mannix. I have used volunteers, use them on a regular basis. I think Jackson County had a volunteer program that was similar to that. I'm not sure it still exists. You know, the problems you would have with that is that, once again, our offenders today aren't the ones that we had yesterday. The judges are often trying to put those first time on bench probation, try a graduated sanction process before they get on formal probation. But yes, you're right, the system needs to be looked at. Under Senate Bill 1145, it required, it tied judges' hands into putting almost probably 80% of offenders that have been convicted on probation. Plus, we see every, with post-prison supervision, we see every offender that's released from our prisons. So the burden is high there. It doesn't appear to us, because we're kind of the forgotten child of the criminal justice system. Not a lot of people know what we do, and you don't see us in the media a lot, and you don't see how we change people's behavior. But I know the funding is short. I recognize that. We do have overburdened caseloads, and I don't have all the answers to that, but the problem with volunteers, I suppose, is they come and go. They're looking for, you know, employment, and you get them trained, and it's very frustrating, and then they leave. And the contact with the offender is very important to establish to keep that offender on track. So,
well, someday
but
we may talk
I understand.
About a more
yes.
coordinated
sure.
system of volunteers. It's always occurred to me that if you took retired public employees who presently have to pay for their health insurance, provided them with an opportunity to sign up as volunteers and do a certain number of hours per month to assist some of their fellow public employees, that maybe we could compensate them by paying their health insurance premium.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not an issue to address in this bill. I'm just amazed that some of the folks in the administration haven't picked up my not-so-subtle hints that they look at these kinds of ways of helping out, helping retirees stay active, and helping pay insurance premiums for retirees.
I'll let the other two of you comment, though, on my sort of question and remarks, and then I'll get back to Rev. Bowman. Did either of you want to remark on what I was just asking about?
Well, my name is Jennifer Cameron, and I'm a parole and probation officer in Linn County, and I have been for about 8 years. I understand the concerns that some of the managers have, but I also know we have concerns to the effectiveness and quality of service we provide the offenders and to the public. I understand what you're saying, and I don't have really any answers except for it's definitely something that maybe can be addressed. Hopefully we can come to an agreement outside of this hearing that may solve some of the issues, at least for today.
And I'll get to you in a moment. I just want to let the third person. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Tracy Poliano. I guess one comment that I had in that was made by one of the judges that supervises a lot of our offenders, one of the domestic violence judges, was that he felt that with the combined unit that we had with the corrections tax and support staff and probation officers, that their court got the best bang for their buck, essentially, out of having an integrated unit where we don't substitute parole and probation supervision. For what I do is not parole and probation supervision, but I think there are innovative ways to look at the system where you can have really good supervision without spending more and more money all the time.
Now, Representative Bowman, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a brief comment. I just wanted to remind this committee that we passed legislation earlier this week or last week. They're all running together now. That would require anybody, whether it's a violation or a misdemeanor, to have supervision on the local level. And so as we continue to broaden the number of people that require supervision, then we have to look at the system about how we're going to be able to do that. And those are people who are very low level, but you're talking about raising the number of supervision tremendously.
I'd say that we're creating a lot of pressure for next session to see the public safety funding gets one-tenth as much attention as the public education funding, and then maybe we can do something here. That's almost a political comment.
Let's not go there.
I think it's me on that.
All right. Did you want to add any other comments at this time? Thank you very much for coming this morning. And we have Paul Frank and Barbara Simon. And the reason some people are pulling off from the committee is that session started at 10, so they're getting down there. I did note that there's some entertainment being provided for opening ceremonies, so we're doing pretty well. Representative Simceri has one of the first bills up, and Representative Simmons always has to be there as the majority whip, has to whip those Republicans into line.
Part of the entertainment.
I didn't say that.
Good morning and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Paul Frank. Excuse me. I retired as a parole officer March 1st after being in this profession for 33 years, 28 of them in Oregon. And I'm here to ask you to consider amendments to Senate Bill 686. I believe that the work group you all talked about forming to add certain prohibitions that I've outlined on the first page of my letter dated May 12th, six of them, would codify the necessary things that a parole and probation officer should be doing and a paraprofessional should not be doing. I was involved in the lawsuit that Ms. Clausen referred to, and to answer your question, the Washington County case that prohibited paraprofessionals from doing parole and probation officer work did go and was adjudicated at the Court of Appeals level. And so that is a court of record case. And the Multnomah County case has yet to get a final order, but the case was, in essence, won by the union. And they indicated that Multnomah County continued to violate the law in spite of the fact that the Washington County case was a case of record. They continued to violate that law even after their own county council in writing told them they were violating the law, and I think that's a serious point. Representative Mannix, I agree that first-time offenders could be handled in a different manner. Unfortunately, we see very few first-time offenders.
Believe me, I'm talking of mythical situations right now because
you're not going to get the first-time bad check writer or whatever.
The point of the matter is, in Multnomah County right now, 65% of those offenders placed on probation out of circuit court go immediately to a case bank type of program. That's a dial 1-900 self-report type of program. Those people in there are, as the director testified at the trial, they are the low, limited, to reoffend offenders that are in that case bank. There's over 3,000 of them. Well, what are their crimes of conviction? Eight of them, this is as of June of last year, eight were under supervision for murder, 15 for manslaughter and negligent homicide, 128 for felony assault, 108 for weapons violations, 140 for first-degree burglary, 64 for robbery one or two, and 772 for manufacturing and distribution of controlled substances. Those people are going directly to a case bank where at that time those caseloads were 400, 500, 600, and the primary contact was with paraprofessionals. That's inappropriate. That is inappropriate. Another thing that lawsuit brought forth is an issue that hasn't been raised yet, but the court in Multnomah County said that a practice that our department, Multnomah County Department, was using was to hire temporary parole and probation officers. Those are paraprofessionals that never have been certified. The judge ruled that they could use those people in that form of employment as a temporary parole and probation officer for 364 days and then terminate that employment. They didn't have to register them with the DPSST. They didn't have to meet qualifications or be screened. That needs to be remedied, and I've suggested language on page 2 of my letter to Representative Mann, to do that. Lastly, I think the thing that needs to be done, as long as we're looking at certification and qualifications, et cetera, is I think we need to realize that some departments, including Multnomah County, hire people that have criminal records, including felony records, including serious misdemeanor records, that have drug abuse histories. And I think the public has a right to expect that sworn personnel or paraprofessionals that have access to all that information do not have those kind of backgrounds. And on page 1 of the letter under section 2, or under number 2 in section 1, I recommended some language that non-certified people would not be able to be employed if they have felony convictions, if they have misdemeanor convictions for person-to-person crimes or sex offense crimes, or have had an active drug history in the last 10 years. Lastly, I recommended those same conditions on number 9 on the second page of that for parole and probation officers. I'm not sure why the people want to hire people that have questionable backgrounds when, in fact, there are numerous applicants that have sterling backgrounds in history, education, etc. So I guess I'm saying that I think Senate Bill 686 needs to be passed, but it needs to be passed with the right prohibitions and protections for the community, for parole officers. I think there definitely is a place for paraprofessionals in this business. As one of the previous officers testified, there's more work of a nature that could be done by a paraprofessional than you can imagine. I've outlined those on the very last page of this handout, and there are numerous things they could do. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Barbara Simon?
Good morning, Representative Mannix, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Simon. I work for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, but I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I will try to be the briefest witness that you've had so far. We would like to be included in your work group. We have some concerns with 686, not so much for what it says, but for what it doesn't say. When you include a list in legislation, you have given tacit approval to everything that's not included in the list. And we're concerned that not today and not tomorrow, but down the road, things will be done that was never the intent of this body by paraprofessionals for a variety of reasons, none of which may be malicious. We've got concerns with home visits. We have concerns with notification for sex offenders. And we have concerns with how security is performed in custodial facilities. A custodial facility, even a treatment facility, have people there with limited freedom. a correctional facility have people there with limited freedom. And most of the time, you can control the secure environment with verbal commands. However, there are times when you need to use more than the verbal command, and that takes training. The concern is that down the road, paraprofessionals will be asked to perform functions for which they are not trained, and as long as the legislation has decided to use lists to help define what can and can't be done, we believe that the list needs to be added to, and we would really appreciate being part of the working group.
Thank you very much. What I'd like to ask you to do, of course, is to participate in the work group, and I know that Dennis Mulvihill has been a moving agent in this process. I'm going to ask him to coordinate the work group, but also Brian DeLaschmidt and Mary Botkin ought to be involved in this. And I'm going to let the work group sort of be self-defined with Elise Clausen and the other witnesses who are here today. In other words, those who want to participate, feel free to participate. Representative Bowman has asked that she be one of the contact persons from this committee. But I will also be a contact person from this committee. That doesn't mean I'm going to sit in on all the meetings. But Representative Przanski?
I'd like to also be notified of when the meetings are, not that I can be there, but I'd at least like to have that opportunity.
Right. So you've got three, and Representative Przanski, Representative Bowman, and myself. And I'm going to ask that John Horton be kept up to speed. I'd like folks to be sitting down over the next few days and seeing whether or not there can be some agreement. It might be that the way to approach this is to talk more in the positive sense of what I wanted to say paralegals, the paraprofessionals would be doing, and trying to define certain kinds of roles in a positive sense rather than an exclusion type sense. And I appreciate your coming this morning to testify. It's been very helpful. Oh, Representative Hansen. Yeah.
Well, certainly I not only would like to be a contact person, but if I can do anything to help expedite it, I certainly would volunteer. The other issue is I don't, based on all the testimony we heard today, I don't know if we can, within the framework of 686, if we can cover all the bases within the time limits that we're going to have, but certainly there may be some other issues that we may want to have identified and put on the list for further work at a different time.
All right. I'm also going to thank you both very much. Invite up Mary Botkin and Brian DeLaschmidt to see if you – we kind of put you last because you're in town. And I know you represent different organizations, but we work with both of you, and I know you work together as need be. So
we kind of like each other most of the time.
Please go ahead.
For the record, Brian DeLaschmidt, representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. You've actually, I think, heard a pretty good distilling of the issues. Just to give you a little historical background, though, what actually has transpired as far as the listing is in an attempt to kind of delineate what's purely PO function versus what is potentially a paraprofessional function. Dennis Mulvihill and I asked each of our organizations or our groups to say, okay, give us a list of what is PO functions. And we start comparing those lists. And what you have in front of you as far as 686 right now are those areas of basic agreement that we already had coming over from the Senate. What you didn't see and what you're starting to hear now are six or seven issues that were not in agreement on the Senate side, but the Senate moved forward anyway, assuming that the House somehow would fix it. And so that's what you've been given the task of, is fix the additional controversial issues, and we're more than willing to obviously work in a work group. In the hallway, we did, I think, get, I'd say, at least 75% to 80% of the way to resolving those additional six issues, and I think they're solvable. There may be one sticking point dealing with one particular county that we're concerned about, but I think we can get there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Botkin with Anthony Council 75, and we have the we're in a difficult position of having representation on both sides of this aisle, and we represent some parole and probation officers. We also represent the corrections techs. And I just have to say that I'm more than willing to work in the work group. I'm actually going to try and get one of our techs to spring her loose out of Multnomah County or somewhere and have her really work a little closer with this issue. I see the issue kind of as one of that just needs to be worked through a little more carefully. I think there's nothing that's more important to us right now than protecting those corrections techs who are in the position that they're in now, making sure that they're not somehow downgraded or denigrated into, you know, a glorified clerical role. I mean, we worked very hard at professionalizing an assistant position and a paraprofessional position that allows them to do more, to have more contact, but without putting them at risk. And our union would be adamantly opposed to placing any of those individuals at risk. We have serious concerns about the home visits issue. I don't disagree with Barbara Simon at all that when you do lists, you've given tacit approval to what's not on the list. But Brian and I had the unfortunate, we were in the unfortunate position last session at 2 o'clock in the morning of trying to find a solution to this and waking up some poor parole and probation parole officer down in Lane County in the middle of the night who said, who couldn't think about what it was we were trying to tell him over the phone, so the bill died. But I do think that we should be able to fix this and come to some conclusions. I'm willing to work on it as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else that signed up to testify on Senate Bill 686 who was not called up? All right, what I'd mentioned to everybody is we consider ourselves a public safety, community-friendly oriented committee, we would hope that all members of the public safety family can work this out, and we will try to accommodate that process, and we'll be available to accommodate the process. And we do want to see some legislation that refines and defines this to the satisfaction of all concerned, if at all possible. But I figure if we can resolve the firearms bill, we ought to be able to resolve this one. But I'm going to rely more on other people this time. Thank you all very much. I would ask, too, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. We also had Senate Bill 685 up, and obviously I need to get off the session now. What I would propose to do would be to bring that up again later when we're bringing up 686. Does that sound like the smart thing to do? It looks like it does. So for the record, we'll convene the public hearing on Senate Bill 685. I'll indicate that we've heard from witnesses on Senate Bill 686. We will try to resolve the issues in Senate Bill 686 in tandem with what may arise in Senate Bill 685, and we'll bring this back up at a later date for possible work session. This concludes the hearing on Senate Bill 685, and we are adjourned.